Welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host this week, Tom Wheeler, Executive Director of EPIC, the Environmental Protection Information Center. And joining me is my friend, colleague, and co-host, Colin Fisk, Executive Director of the Coalition for Responsible Transportation Priorities. Hey, Colin.
Hi, Tom.
And we are joined by a friend of the show, Arnie Jacobson, the Director of the Schatz Energy Research Center at Cal Poly Humboldt. Hey, Arnie.
Hey there. Thanks for having me on. Good to be here.
So we are going to be talking about a new report that was put out by Schatz on our electrical grid. And I promise that we're going to make this exciting. And I promise that we're going to cause you at the end of this radio show to leave and to know something more about how energy is distributed here on the North Coast. Let's set the stage of why this matters. Arnie, what's the most recent big news that we've seen come out of the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management?
The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, or BOEM, as it's referred to in circles where people pay attention to them, it just released a proposed sale notification for leasing two wind energy areas on the California coast, one about 20 miles offshore from Humboldt Bay, and the other is offshore from the San Luis Obispo coast and is referred to as the Morro Bay Wind Energy Area. So they released that notification last week. And that initiates a process that involves a 60-day comment period and will eventually lead to holding the lease auction later this year. That would enable whichever wind developers that are selected to proceed with putting together plans or proposals to develop offshore wind in the respective areas.
So we are one step closer to our floating offshore wind future, which is very exciting for all of us who want to see our energy decarbonized as rapidly as possible to try to address the pressing threat of global climate catastrophe. But we have some problems here, and this is what we're going to talk about today. We're talking about our energy grid here coming into Humboldt County and also kind of, I guess, leaving Humboldt County. It goes both ways. I've often experienced that people don't get the energy grid, that people think that you can precisely track an electron from one place to another, that when you buy power from one location, you can guarantee that it's going to come to you from that location. Let's kind of talk about what an energy grid is and how it works and use some folksy analogies here to help people understand how the energy grid works. So Arnie, can you talk about grids, broadly speaking, how they work? And then we can start to narrow in to Humboldt County in specific and how our local grid works here.
Sure. I guess at a very high level, the electrical grid is all of the infrastructure, all of the wires and switchgear and safety equipment and energy conversion devices that connect the generation sources of electricity to the end users. And there's a lot of different ways that the grid can be configured. There's a lot of complexity to it, but essentially that's what it is. It's the wires and all of the other equipment that's needed to move electricity from the generation sources to the end users. In California, a big section of the grid is managed. It's the transmission and distribution infrastructure is mostly owned by the utilities in our region, Pacific Gas and Electric, but is the buying and selling and management of that system is operated by something called the California Independent System Operator. And so part of what the grid is a system that's managed by the independent system operator, which interacting with the utilities that own the infrastructure.
And then to use the folksy analogy, I often kind of think about energy transmission as pipes. You can have a pipe that is one diameter or 1 inch in diameter, and it can provide a flow of a certain rate. And then if you have a bigger pipe, you can have a flow of an even larger rate. Is that kind of one way to think about the movement of power?
It is. Using sort of water and pipes as an analogy has limitations. It doesn't describe, you can't take that analogy too far, but I think in general terms, it's maybe a good place to start at a high level.
All right. Well, I bring up pipe size because what we here in Humboldt County, our pipes are too small, perhaps. And this is going to present some sort of a challenge towards developing, to fully building out our wind energy potential here off of the North Coast.
Yeah, that's That's correct. That I sometimes like to say, I guess it's not the same as pipes, but it's almost the same as pipes. I sometimes like to say that we're connected here on the North Coast by a couple of capillaries. And really those connections that we have are designed to interconnect us with the main grid and to supply power to this region that is reasonably well matched with the local load in this region. It's actually they're not even quite that big. We have to have local generation here on the North Coast in order to meet our local load. And the main generator that does that is the natural gas power plant that's just south of Eureka at King Salmon, which is owned and operated by Pacific Gas and Electric. That power plant is able to supply the full load here on the North Coast. And the transmission lines that we have sort of synchronize everything that's happening with what's with the rest of the main grid, but they're not even quite big enough to supply our full load. So that puts us in a position where things operate reasonably well here on the North Coast, as long as the power plant is able to function and as long as the power lines are operating. But we're dependent on that power plant and we're dependent on those lines not going down, or at least not for very long. But if you start to add a significant amount of generation here on the North Coast, such as an offshore wind farm, they're not designed to handle that. So they could allow for a small, relatively small wind farm that could utilize that existing capacity. But anything that is of significant scale, that would be of significance at the level that would make a difference for meeting California's climate and clean energy goals, those transmission lines are too small.
So, Arnie, a question that I think some folks might have coming out of that description is, can we just replace the Humboldt Bay Generating Station with a wind farm? And if not, why not? Or what do we need to do?
So we can't just replace the Humboldt Bay Generating Station with a wind farm and call it good, because a wind farm is going to generate intermittently when there's wind. And so the offshore wind resources is actually pretty consistent, but it's not consistent enough to deliver power whenever we want. There's always going to be some periods of calm when it's not going to generate anything at all, or where the output's going to be very small. And the difference with a natural gas power plant is that will operate whenever you feed it fuel. And so it's what we call a dispatchable resource that can be used to match the load. So adding a wind farm could significantly reduce the amount of natural gas that's needed to operate that plant. It could really reduce the amount of energy that comes from fossil fuels in this region, but it couldn't replace having that plant entirely on its own. Now, if you put in a wind farm and upgraded the transmission so that the transmission line was large enough to supply all of the power in our region, even if the wind was completely calm and there was nothing coming from that direction, then you could not have the natural gas plant. But you would need that upgraded transmission in order to do that, because we need a line that's big enough we actually need two lines, because you want a redundant system that are big enough to supply the local load here, even if other generation sources in the region are not producing anything at a given moment.
So to summarize, for people like myself who aren't terribly bright, our pipes are functionally too small here into Humboldt County, or as you said, the capillaries that are feeding us here. I really like the body analogy too. I'm going to steal that one in the future, Arnie. They're too small, so we can't live off of that power that comes in through them. We have to generate our own power here at the Humboldt Bay Generating Station, and until we kind of expand the capacity to both import and export power, our ability to build out a wind farm is going to be limited, because we just don't have the pipe isn't big enough. God, that I need to come up with a better way of saying it.
Well, so there's one more element I think we should address. I don't know what the analogy from a body perspective would be, but where does storage or batteries fit into this picture?
Storage can definitely help manage the intermittency of a wind farm and help to smooth out that generation, and can help improve the economics of a wind farm. At the same time, batteries can help improve electricity reliability and resilience in our region. You would have to have a very large battery in order to completely replace the power plant. To have not upgrade the transmission lines, to have the wind farm, and then use a battery as a replacement for the power plant, that battery would have to be quite large, because there might be periods 3, 4, 5, 6 days at a stretch when there wouldn't be any wind. It doesn't happen very often, but occasionally we'll have sequential periods of calm that are that long. And so the battery would then have to carry a significant portion of carrying the local load through that period. Batteries certainly can play. Storage is a piece of the picture. We've done a little bit of analysis about that certainly indicates that including storage can be beneficial in multiple ways. But I don't see it as a complete solution for replacing the power plant.
Grid constraints, our ability to export capacity, excess capacity, limit the size of a wind farm that can be built now, absent improvements to the grid. What is the size? What is the size of project that we could functionally support with local demand at this moment?
Actually, I think it's worth stepping back and getting to that in a second.
Okay.
if we look at the wind and energy area that the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management has defined, it's about 207 square miles, and it's about 20 miles offshore from Humboldt Bay. And if you fully built out the largest wind farm that could fit in that area, that might be something on the order of 1,600 to 1,800 megawatts of power. Just as a point of comparison, the local average load in our region is 100 megawatts. So 16 to 18 times larger installed capacity than the average load in our region. So the potential to generate wind energy is quite a bit larger than is matched with our local load. And the Humboldt Bay Power Plant is 163 megawatts. So it's big enough not just to meet our average load, but to meet our peak load in this region with a little bit of clearance. And so that's just sort of the pieces that we're starting with. And then the transmission lines that come in and out, maybe they can export 70 or 75 megawatts or import the same amount. And so those are sort of the numbers that we're dealing with. If you were to install a wind farm that needed to fit within the existing infrastructure without upgrading the transmission lines, probably something on the order of 150 megawatts could be developed. There would be some times when you would need to curtail energy from that plant just because the transmission lines, you know, the combination of the local load and other generation sources and the transmission lines, that, you know, there would be a constraint and you wouldn't be able to accept all of the power from the wind farm. But most of the time, something on that size would work reasonably well. That's based on projected loads for the year 2030 and projected generation sources and other things for that year. And that's a result from the analysis that our team led. And I should note that we did that work as a partnership with the National Renewable Energy Lab and consulting firm called Quanta Technology. So it was really a joint effort and one that was funded by the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management.
So Arnie, you mentioned the projected load, and as a transportation person, I have to ask, how do you account for the electrification of our transportation systems and also our buildings, which are some of the key steps towards addressing the climate crisis that Tom was mentioning earlier?
The projected load that we used in the base case for our analysis was built on the Redwood Coast Energy Authority's projected load to the year 2025. And then we assume 2% annual growth from there out to 2030. That accounts for a modest amount of electrification of transportation and buildings, but it's not really an aggressive case. And so we also did an augmented load case analysis to say, you know, what happens if there's a somewhat faster growth of electrification of transportation and buildings, and how much of a difference does that make? That indicated that you could build a somewhat larger wind farm in the case that the local load grows more quickly. Maybe instead of 150, maybe you would be able to build something that's closer to maybe 180 or 190 megawatts. So it's modestly larger, but not dramatically larger. And that doesn't mean you would be meeting all of the local load. It's just that at a certain point, the transmission lines create a constraint and you can't build something bigger without upgrading the transmission lines.
Well, actually, first, I wanted to ask a clarifying question about curtailment. You said that when we are doing a build out for a Humboldt-sized project, an initial project, there would still be times when it would be necessary to curtail production. For a wind turbine, what does that look like? How do we curtail wind energy?
What it essentially means is that there's the grid isn't able to accept that power safely. And so the wind farm operator needs to essentially shut down, not necessarily all, but a portion of its output, meaning that some of the turbines have to be either, there's a couple of different ways that can be done. You can, one way is essentially just applying brakes so that each of the turbines produces a little bit less output. And the other is to just shut off some of the turbines. How they approach it is really up to them.
Yeah, you can change the pitch of the blade so that it kind of cuts differently, so it doesn't grab as much wind. Yeah.
Yeah.
The Eco News Report, we are talking about our grid infrastructure and how it might limit the development of future floating offshore wind turbines. Shall we talk about expanding our grid capacity to match our production potential here on the North Coast? So as you said, we have a 207-mile wind call area off of Humboldt's coast that's capable of producing just a ton of energy, a massive amount of energy that would go a long way in meeting our California demand for renewable power. But to do that, we need to improve our grid infrastructure. What are we talking about here? How daunting is this challenge?
It's fairly significant, but not undoable. I think there's a few different things that need to be considered. One is just cost. When it comes to transmission line upgrades, they're fairly expensive. And the estimated cost, I guess there's two different studies that I'm going to refer to. One is a study that was led by Pacific Gas and Electric in collaboration with our team at the Schott Center that was published back in the year 2020. And then the second is analysis that was done by the California Independent System Operator at the request of the California Public Utilities Commission as part of the state's transmission planning process. And both of those studies had fairly similar assumptions in terms of the scenarios and reached fairly similar conclusions in terms of the cost. But either way, the estimated costs are at the lower end, maybe a little over $1 billion, and at the upper end, maybe closer to $4 billion, depending on what route is taken and some other specifics. And so cost is a significant element of the story. I think a second question is route, like where would these transmission lines go? And in terms of the route, there's multiple issues that have to be thought about. The existing rights of way for the transmission lines that are already there are not large enough to put in significantly larger lines that would be needed. And so either those rights of way would need to be expanded or new rights of way would need to be identified, which it's always complicated to identify and secure rights of way when you're going across multiple properties and over a couple hundred miles. That's a challenging thing to do. It's not impossible. State has to do that kind of thing all the time, but
we did it once before, right? That's how we did it in the first place.
Yes, but it was a different time.
And, yeah.
Yeah. And then environmental and cultural resource issues come into play. Certainly transmission lines are associated with a set of environmental impacts to birds, to whatever is removed in the pathway, et cetera. So those things have to be considered as well as cultural resources. So all of those things come into play and have to be considered, as well as any existing uses that are along those rights of way. Usually transmission upgrade processes, when they're of significant scale, don't happen quickly. So a decade wouldn't be unusual. In fact, might be fast. So all of those things are challenges associated with the process.
Arnie, who would go about doing that process? Is this something that we'd have to rely on a private entity like PG&E, or does grid upgrades like this, does it go through a governmental agency?
There's a couple of different pathways for proposing transmission upgrades. There is a state transmission planning process. The study that the California ISO did is a part of that process, but if an actual transmission line gets identified and approved through that process, then that sets up one pathway. And then there's another where a private entity proposes to build something. One of the big differences between those processes is just how the finances work for developing the transmission. But either way, everything has to be permitted through the state, through the respective state processes. And for transmission lines that cross state borders, there's also a federal process for that permitting. But in this case, that wouldn't necessarily have to be true. It wouldn't have to, you know, all of this could be within California for the scenario that we're talking about. And so I guess the short story is the financing for these things typically does come from a private entity, but the ultimate cost of paying for the transmission upgrades is generally borne by ratepayers of the utilities that are associated with the electricity that's eventually sold. And so it could be that PG&E would be the private entity that would develop the transmission, but it's also quite possible that it would be a different private entity that would lead development of the transmission.
So if you start to stack costs on top of each other for grid infrastructure improvements, as well as just the cost of wind turbine energy, that it's going to be coming from these offshore plants, which I imagine is already going to be pretty expensive, does it start to price out the feasibility of floating offshore wind to price out one of these large project developments?
I don't think that it necessarily does. The cost of offshore wind is almost certainly going to be somewhat higher than the cost of solar energy, especially solar energy from the sunniest parts of the state. But sort of the average cost per kilowatt hour delivered is not necessarily the only metric that we need to pay attention to, because the timing of when that energy is delivered also ends up being quite important to the story in terms of the overall valuation. And solar energy, of course, is a fantastic resource and undoubtedly necessarily will be a key part of the state's energy portfolio. But we're already facing challenges associated with having so much of our renewable energy come from solar, because it comes in the middle of the day and there's so much more of it in summer than there is in winter. And that creates some challenges associated with managing the electrical grid. Offshore wind is complementary to solar in two very nice ways. One is that its generation profile is reasonably strong overnight, so it's fairly balanced over the 24-hour period. There's always periods of calm, but when you look at the average profile over the course of a year, it's pretty stable over the 24-hour period. And it's also quite good in winter. It's even slightly stronger in summer, but it isn't, the difference between the two is not nearly as large as it is for solar energy. And so complement that offshore wind provides to solar energy, I think, makes it super valuable. And the cost of the transmission can seem high, but we're going to have to build a lot of transmission in a lot of context, regardless of which renewable resources we're looking to bring in. And the amount that is needed to facilitate the delivery of offshore wind is not necessarily higher than it would be for some of the other things that we might consider as possibilities. And so that part of it, I think, as a state, we're going to have to investing in transmission one way or the other.
And floating offshore wind, it's a nascent industry. It is these sorts of things that are publicly desirable, that are good for the public good, are often supported and subsidized in their initial development. And this is how they ever in the future become commercially viable. I hope that the state and feds recognize this and also help to support the floating offshore wind industry as it's trying to get its legs under them, or tail, or whatever it is when you're floating. Colin, go ahead.
Yeah, just one more question related to the cost and, picking up on something you said earlier, Arnie. A lot of us are feeling a lot of urgency about getting resources like this onto the grid. The best projections are that maybe we have 10 or 15 years to mostly or entirely decarbonize. And you were talking about just how long it takes typically to upgrade the transmission. And I mean, also to build a big utility scale system like that. I guess maybe this is a question you can't answer, but will we be able to do it in time, especially as we're adding more electric load to the grid from transportation and buildings and so forth?
We should move as fast as we can with the best solutions that we have. Whether or not it's quite fast enough, it's hard for me to say that's a hard question to answer. I think it's important when it comes to addressing climate change to have as much ambition as we can while still keeping in mind the need to address other environmental issues as we go, and to address equity and social justice issues in relationship to that. So we don't want to expand so quickly that we're forgetting about those other issues. And in fact, we want to think about all of those things together. And we need to go very quickly. And state processes and federal processes are not necessarily well matched with that. I think our current administration in California recognizes that, whether or not those things can be addressed or streamlined as quickly as they need to be is one thing. But I think there's certainly recognition of the importance and a commitment to the importance of trying to address these issues within the state. I think that's also true, but with a more complicated political situation at the federal level as well, that there are people within the administration who understand the urgency. But understanding the urgency and being able to change a set of processes that have been in place for a long time is another thing. And so it's hard to say whether or not we'll be fast enough, but we certainly shouldn't stop trying to move things as quickly as we can. And I say that because I think sometimes it's easy to stop and really examine each individual project really carefully and to question this and to question that. And those are good discussions to have, but at the same time, we need to keep the big picture in mind, which is that we need to move quickly on these things. And it's not just up to the government to figure that part out. It's also up to all of us to be working to push things in the direction that we need to be heading if things are going to succeed.
I promised Jen called a humble baykeeper that I'd ask you about green hydrogen and the potential to use excess energy that we might produce to create hydrogen fuel that we could then use locally for school buses or whatever it is that we might need it for.
So our team did do a little bit of analysis, very preliminary analysis related to the potential for generating hydrogen energy or hydrogen fuel from, especially from some of the curtailed energy that might occur in a wind farm during times when the grid can't absorb or deliver all of that power. And I think there's still a bit of work to do, but that analysis did suggest that there are circumstances where you could generate enough energy to meet what you might imagine for the needs of local bus transit and other maybe heavy duty vehicle applications where hydrogen might make sense, that might be done in a way that could be cost competitive with importing hydrogen from outside of the area. And so at a modest scale, you might be able to use green hydrogen generation in that way. If you're looking to export hydrogen from this region, then the circumstance is fairly different, where it probably wouldn't make sense to do that at a sort of small to modest scale, because the cost of transporting or delivering the hydrogen could be fairly high and make it tough to compete, unless you go to a really, really large scale where you're able to invest in the infrastructure that's needed to deliver that hydrogen in a cost-effective way. And that really large scale demand for green hydrogen doesn't yet exist in the state. There's not a framework in place that creates the demand in the market for green hydrogen at that scale. So it could be that will emerge. But if I were thinking about investing my own money in that kind of a thing, it's not what I would invest in right now, because I don't see the framework in place that makes that a clearly a good investment for what might happen 10 or 12 years from now.
Well, thank you, Arnie. And here's hoping that someday we can reverse the pipeline that currently carries methane into the Humble Bay Generating Station, and maybe that will be an export pipeline for green hydrogen to fuel the rest of California, or something also really cool. Thank you, Arnie, and the Schatz Energy Research Center for this new report, which you can find on the Schatz website, which you can access from thelostcoastoutpost.com, where we post our show notes. Join us again next week on this time and channel for more environmental news from the North Coast of California.